The Athletic.
Hi there, this is the Athletic FC podcast weekend preview. It is match day 34 in the Premier League, but we also have the FA Cup semi-finals. My name is Adam Leventhal. Welcome if you are listening, if you are watching on YouTube as well. Alongside me is Tim Spears. It's lovely to be back in the studio with you, feeling your warmth, your vibes.
Yeah, you too, yeah.
Tim is here and Liam is also here, but remotely. How are you, Liam?
Not so good now. I felt that passive-aggressive dig at my non-presence.
No, I was remote last week, so I'm all aboard the remote train. So do not take it as a slight. I wanted to ask both of you before we kick on with everything that we're going to be looking ahead to. I wanted to talk about penalties because Tim, obviously, we've had a big Champions League week. Obviously, didn't go to plan for Arsenal against Bayern Munich. Didn't go to plan for Manchester City against Real Madrid, and it came down to penalties. And you wrote in depth about the penalty shootout. Did you enjoy that process?
Yeah, it was okay because you get to sort of pause and look at all the facial expressions and you notice things that you wouldn't do normally. I found the person who nicked the ball from after Modric hoofed it into the stand behind the goal, which was proved very costly because that ended up being, due to my research, the longest wait in between penalties by almost double. Bernardo Silva had to wait a minute before he took his penalty.
Interesting. If you want to read more about it, it's on The Athletic right now. And Liam, from the sort of sublime analysis and high-level penalty shootout to the ridiculous scenes at Stamford Bridge when anyone but Cole Palmer, who was trying to get the ball off Cole Palmer, is just a nonsense. What was going on there? And are you disappointed that it overshadowed what was actually a really, really great performance from Chelsea?
I think a lot of people at Chelsea were disappointed that it overshadowed the most emphatic scoreline of the season. And Pochettino, his frustration came through in the post-match press conference when all but one of the questions related to that penalty farce.
Did you ask a question, Liam? Because that footage is great of Pochettino and a journalist. So I still don't know who that is.
Yeah, what to take us into the room?
No, I can't. Unfortunately, I wasn't in the room. I wasn't at the game.
Oh, okay.
I only saw the next day the mad drama that had unfolded. But it was, you know, four or five questions devoted to what people had seen and. You can understand that from a journalist's perspective. It was the most newsy thing that had happened in the game and people wanted to explore it because it was so unusual. And to his credit, Pochettino didn't minimise it. You know, he didn't pull his punches really, criticising Madueke and Jackson and saying, on the whole, you know, we can't behave like kids. Football's a collective sport. And he made it crystal clear. You can argue that maybe he hasn't before this season, that Cole Palmer is the official penalty taker. You know, earlier in the year, according to Pochettino, it was basically just which player feels most confident. That was actually how Palmer got the job against Burnley away earlier in the season. Now, he's since very much made that job his own, scoring all nine of the kicks that he's taken. And even more impressively, scoring all nine despite having lengthy VAR waits for many of those kicks in high pressure moments and teammates actively trying to take the ball off him. So incredible mental strength and stability from Cole Palmer.
Yeah. And as we discussed with Bernardo Silva, delays don't help when you're taking penalties, and for him to be so cool under pressure has been, one of the features of a very, very impressive season for Cole Palmer. Right. It's the favourite part of the show for Tim Spears. We're going to get stuck into our fixture formation. The Premier League fixture formation this week is 3-4. But we also have two other games which we are looking ahead to. So technically, we do have two formations. So we've got 2 3 o'clocks on Saturday, Luton against Brentford, Sheffield United against Burnley. We will be talking about the relegation scrap later on, which involves obviously all four of those teams. Then at 5:15, it is Man City against Chelsea at Wembley in that first FA Cup semi-final. We'll have a focus on that as well. Then back to the Premier League at 7:30 on Saturday. Arsenal trying to get back on track against Tim Spears' Wolves at Molineux. Back onto Sunday, we've got Everton against Nottingham Forest, also part of that relegation scrap chat that we'll have a little bit later on. That's at 1:30. Crystal Palace against West Ham, and Aston Villa versus Bournemouth is at 3 o'clock on Sunday. And then it is Fulham against Liverpool at 4:30. And then sandwiched between those Premier League games on Sunday is the other Cup semi-final. Wolves' conquerors, Coventry, against Manchester United. But we're going to be starting with Manchester City against Chelsea. So it is indeed the first semi-final. And Liam, let's focus on Chelsea first of all, because it's been another strange season for the fans, for the people covering the side as well. They're ninth in the Premier League, albeit they do have that game in hand. And if they win, they're going to be up to sixth potentially in the league. They've still got a chance to get into Europe via the Premier League. There's still a lot to play for, but it does feel like there's a lot riding on this FA Cup semi-final and the potential of winning a trophy. Has there been a lot of focus behind the scenes on winning the FA Cup, or is it just a byproduct of a topsy-turvy season?
I don't know if it's necessarily been a focus, but naturally, as the further you get into these tournaments, the more prominent it becomes in the minds of the players, in the minds of the coach, and in the minds of supporters that winning it could be a possibility. I mean, that notion took a blow when they drew Manchester City in the semi-final, just as it did last year when they drew City away in the third round of both domestic cups. But it is there for them now. You know, I think they know that they've played Manchester City well twice this season in two very, very different games. And so I think they will fancy themselves to a degree to come up with a game plan that causes City problems and to execute that game plan at a level that means we've at least got a competitive game at Wembley. I don't really expect it to be like the 4-4. I expect it to maybe be a little bit more like the 1-1 at the Etihad, but no two games against the Pep Guardiola team are the same, I don't think. I think he'll have spent a long time looking at that Etihad match and how Chelsea cause City problems, the kinds of traps that they set for them in possession, what they did with Rodri in particular, Conor Gallagher shadowing him. And I'm sure Pep will have some left field manoeuvres of his own to try and shake things up a bit. But there is a degree of confidence from Chelsea. They've played City well and they've tended to lift their game for the better teams this season.
Tim, I want to talk to you about wounded animals, if that's okay. Are City going to be a wounded animal that's, you know, sad and down and literally licking their wounds? Or are they going to be like a cat that we were talking about off air that's very, you know, aggressive and defensive and is going to attack because they want to get revenge and want to make up for that bitterness of losing out on the Champions League?
Crikey, there's a lot to unpack there. Are they going to be sad? You said yes, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, there's quite a quick turnaround. Guardiola's probably cursing the fact that this isn't on Sunday. I think this is going to define the run-in as to how these teams cope with their European exits. We spoke on last week's show about the possibility of City v Arsenal in the semi-final of the Champions League and how that would impact the run-in around it. Well, yeah, they're both out of Europe, so how do they come back from adversity this weekend? We've seen with Liverpool how the first leg of the Atalanta game had such an impact on Palace game for me last weekend. So yeah, I think it's a good time to play City. When you've got Rodri asking for time off and when you've got Haaland and De Bruyne apparently asking to be substituted last night. I'm not sure if it was as clear cut as that, but Guardiola basically said, yeah, they asked to come off.
He referenced that, didn't he? Yeah.
Which I find astonishing. In the biggest game of the season, that they're feeling a little bit too tired to carry on. Not sure about that, but still, it kind of reflects the position that they're in. It's been a very draining title race. How you cope with that fatigue and adversity is going to be key to what all these clubs do in the next few weeks.
Let's talk about Cole Palmer Liam. How much have you enjoyed watching his journey so far this season? And how surprised have you been how much he's exceeded expectations? I mean, because there wasn't necessarily any expectation of him really this season, was there?
Well, the only expectation there was of him from outside Chelsea came in the form of a piece that we did for The Athletic shortly after the summer window concluded, where we spoke to a load of agents anonymously. And he was the consensus pick as the worst signing of, I believe, deadline day, but it might have been the entire window. People couldn't understand why Chelsea had paid so much for a guy who was buried in Manchester City squad, who'd barely played in the Premier League to that point. And they all know exactly why now. You know, he's really, you know, an emerging Premier League superstar. I don't think that's too strong to say. This is a large enough sample size, and he's been consistent enough that it merits that kind of billing. And the biggest surprise for me has been that he was good from day one. From the moment he started playing in this team, he's shown the qualities that you see from him now, just making good decisions whenever he gets the ball and taking responsibility, assuming a leadership role in what is a very young squad. And when I say leadership, I don't mean, you know, ordering players about and acting like a captain, but being like a technical leader on the pitch, you know, someone who always wants the ball, who wants the burden of scoring or creating. And I don't think we haven't seen enough of those players at Chelsea actually in the last few years. And for someone who wants that, but is also good enough to justify it regularly, while being also a natural showman. I mean, you look at his first goal against Everton, the nutmeg of Branthwaite, the little flick round the corner, and then the finish. That's one of the best goals of the season by anyone. And it sums up Cole Palmer. It's not just the quality, it's the swagger and the general way that he carries himself on the pitch.
Are you a big fan of Cole Palmer?
Yeah, I think in terms of him taking responsibility at such a young age and such an inexperienced player.
Yeah.
It's not like he's been around the lower leagues on loan for the last few years. He's just come in from playing at Man City's academy pitch to do this in the Premier League and just looks totally cool with it all. I mean, he's, what, the form player in the country at the moment, probably, certainly in terms of goal scoring. I think it's 11-6, which is insane. And yeah, it's high motivation for him to do it on an extremely big stage on Saturday.
Yeah, obviously against his former side. I mean, is it? I hate to use a cliche, but is it written in the stars that he's going to play a match winning role, or do you think that, well, this is a strange one, I suppose, because depending on the real reason why Pep Guardiola sold him or allowed him to be sold, we don't necessarily know if it was linked to, you know, FFP and balancing the books and thinking, well, yeah, he's a superstar that, or potential superstar that we have to sell. We're not going to sell X rather than Y. So yeah, he's the one that goes. But it does look like a misjudgment. Presumably Pep Guardiola will be able to have a plan now for him, even though he's going to be in the opposition dressing room, do you think, Liam?
I think he'll definitely be the player that Guardiola is most worried about, because Chelsea's attacking plan, to a certain extent, it's been like this for most of the season, but it's become increasingly so in recent weeks, is just give the ball to Cole Palmer and see what decision he makes, because more often than not, he will pick the right option. And particularly in the game at the Etihad, all of Chelsea's best attacks, and there were quite a lot of them for the first 60, 70 minutes, even though they only scored once, came from Palmer, either initiating the move with a line-breaking pass or, you know, committing a man. He nutmegged Bernardo Silva at one point. You know, he has the ability to create time and space for himself, which is what all of the really impressive players can do. And so I do think Guardiola will be thinking about him a lot. As for it being a misjudgment, we've never got the impression, I'm sure our colleague Sam Lee could talk at more length about this, but we've never got the impression from Manchester City that there's a huge amount of regret. I think they felt that Palmer just wasn't going to get the minutes for them that he's getting for Chelsea, and to get the size of the role that he's getting for Chelsea. You know, it's one thing to be the creative hub of a team that is in mid-table fighting for sixth, seventh, and another to be integral to a team that won the treble last year and has a very strong argument to still be considered the best team in the world. I think from Palmer's perspective as well, he was looking at it thinking, Kevin De Bruyne is the man at Manchester City today. Phil Foden looks like the man at Manchester City tomorrow. Is it ever going to be my day? You know, and I think he's already the man at Chelsea. So in that sense, it's really paid off for him immediately. And in terms of the money City banked, I mean, they did some of their own business that they wanted to do, signing Jeremy Doku. There's an argument that it's worked out best for everyone. But of course, if Palmer goes on to beat City in this game and play well against them for the next 10 years, then we could look upon it differently.
He's the exception rather than the rule as well when you consider the amount of money that Chelsea have spent. And that £1 billion figure is bandied about and used as a massive stick to beat the Bowley era. And you analysed it recently. It's an article that you should dig out and, not you, Liam, obviously you wrote it, but people listening should dig out and read, because you worked out that only four of the recruits of the $1 billion crew have been on the pitch for more than 75% of Chelsea's available first team minutes since arriving. Cole Palmer amongst that group, with Enzo Fernandez, Moises Caicedo and Axel Disasi as well. When you look at that big headline figure, is there any part of you that thinks this has gone to any sort of plan so far? Or is this £1 billion figure always going to look like a mistake, especially at the beginning when it looked a little bit misguided?
Well, one thing I've discovered since that piece went live is that from the publicly reported transfer fees, I actually underestimated Chelsea's transfer spend, because once their accounts dropped, we saw that it's actually £1.2 billion over these first 2 years of Bowley Clear Lake ownership that they've spent on transfers. Maybe that includes the rather lofty agent fees that made headlines as well. But yeah, it's... There's no argument that it's worked as a strategy in the short term, because a lot of these players have not lived up to transfer fees that, honestly, you know, in some cases were always setting them up with impossible expectations. Certainly in the case of Enzo Fernandez, Moises Caicedo, Mykhailo Mudryk, it's really hard for young players to justify fees like that. But also, I think it's clearly not worked because of where Chelsea are in the league. They didn't drive this squad overhaul and spend this much money thinking that the rebuild would be this painful, that they would be mired in Premier League mid-table. They thought they could do this and still be competing for Champions League qualification at a minimum. I think the fact that they haven't been doing that is a reflection on the Premier League being much stronger than they thought it was. But also, the players that they've signed either not being as good as they thought they were, or not being as good right now and needing a bit more time. And there are bigger questions about the wisdom of constructing an entire squad essentially of under 23s. Is that the best way to develop them all? Is that the best environment to create? You saw the Real Madrid team that knocked Manchester City out. They have young players, but they seem to have got succession planning down to a fine art. Their young players already play like champions. There's no one doing the Toni Kroos or Luka Modric role really at Chelsea in terms of mentoring. And that's a bit of an issue. Yeah, so they're big strategic questions, and there may well be in time a lot more success stories than just Cole Palmer, unqualified success stories that we can look at and say, yeah, Chelsea did good business here, but it's not obvious right now.
Let's get our predictions then. Tim, you got one right last week, by the way. You predicted that Villa were going to win at Arsenal. I think you were just being contrary at the time, just for the record, because everyone was predicting that.
Well,
Arsenal
everyone could go back and listen and
no, they can.
See
yeah,
what I said.
Yeah, that's fine. You got one right. Your prediction this week for the FA Cup semi-final between Manchester City and Chelsea.
Well, is it relevant? Does it matter what I say?
Of course it does.
But you're just saying I'm being contrary. If I'm saying one thing one way or the other.
Well, what's more important? What's more important, getting it right or the thinking behind it?
So I think looking at Chelsea's recent defensive records, they had that run of conceding minimum 2 goals in 7 games in a row, mm-hmm. and they played some rubbish in that run. They played Burnley, Sheffield United, Leeds, Leicester. You know, the Everton game doesn't solve those issues for me. I can't see them not conceding a couple of goals. And if Guardiola does a number on Palmer, I don't think they've got the firepower to sort of win 3-2 against City. So I will say,
yeah,
so you asked for a bit of reasoning.
Yeah,
so this,
no, I like it.
So I would say City to win 2-1.
2-1. Thank you. Liam, your prediction, please.
Well, I've already answered this question on Straight Out Cobham, so I have to be consistent with my predictions, I think. Or I just make a mockery of the whole prediction process and just say two completely different things. I actually predicted the same score as Tim, 2-1, a kind of late heartbreak for Chelsea. The one point I'd probably differ on is I'm not sure Guardiola's the type of coach that does a number on opposition players. He doesn't seem to craft that many individual game plans defensively. His defensive game plan will be stop Cole Palmer and any other Chelsea player getting the ball ever.
Yeah.
That seems to be his general approach. But I think there will be some tiredness in City's legs. And I think Chelsea will play them close because they have done twice this year. But I do think City will ultimately come through.
We shall see. Let's talk about the other FA Cup semi-final whilst we're here.
Mm.
Wolves' conquerors, Coventry City, have their big day out at Wembley Stadium. Oh, wouldn't it be nice to if it was Wolves making it to Wembley again to get into the FA Cup semi-final, but they probably would have lost like they did the last time. They
just
were
FYI,
FA
Liam,
Cup
semi-final. I'm not saying anything because I'm not biting. He does this kind of thing every week.
Coventry up against Manchester United. Coventry sit eighth in the Championship. Can they do it again? Have you got a little bit of a hope, maybe?
Yeah, definitely.
That they do it again.
The amount of teams that Man United have been making look amazing in recent weeks is considerable.
Yep.
And yeah, I watched Coventry. Should have been a comfortable win against Wolves, to be honest. They had 24 shots at Molineux that day. And in players like Ellis Sims and Hadji Wright, they've definitely got the firepower to trouble Man United. And Man United have definitely got the defensive weakness to allow them to have chances. I think we can say in almost certainty, given the run that United have been on for months now, that they will concede chances to Coventry. Mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to it. It's a great story for Coventry to be there. They're going to be backed by 34,000, sold out their allocation. Mark Robbins obviously done a phenomenal job. Even this season, they were struggling, weren't they, before Christmas in sort of November. They were in a relegation battle. Now they're sort of on the verge of the playoffs, but it might be too late for that. I honestly think they've got a really good opportunity to create one of the, what would be on paper, one of the biggest FA Cup shocks of all time.
They've got familiarity with the sort of the big theatre that is Wembley, obviously from the playoffs, which will work to their advantage. Obviously, they lost on that occasion to Luton in last season's playoff final. But do you think just in general, though, the familiarity of those Manchester United players will be the deciding factor or not?
In terms of?
Just big matches, big pressure.
You know, there were big games in the Champions League this season and they flunked all those. They've been better against the better teams recently, you know, a couple of decent performances against Liverpool, obviously. Mm-hmm. But against teams that they're expected to beat, they've really struggled. You know, going back a few months now, they played Newport in January, struggled to get past them. Yeah, there's massive issues there. We saw last week Ten Hag again failing to sort of get hold of the dressing room and issues with Garnacho, and Dalot saying completely the opposite things to what Ten Hag's been saying about conceding shots in his post-match interview, and Amad Diallo doing things on social media and Garnacho doing things on social media. So it's just an unruly bunch of players who don't seem to play to direction. And when you've got that, anything can happen in any given game.
I just want one prediction from you on this game, please, Tim.
Man United to win on penalties.
Ah, okay, good. Liam, quick one from you.
Do Coventry have midfielders who can run with the ball in a straight line through the middle of the pitch? Because that could be a bit of a problem for Casemiro et al. I think Coventry are going to score twice in this game.
And Manchester United are going to score.
I think they're going to win. Yeah, 3-2.
3-2. Cool. It's going to be a good weekend. Right, let's get back into the Premier League.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Right. We have next Arsenal away at Wolves. Arsenal suffered back-to-back defeats against Aston Villa, their first league loss in 2024. The 1-0 defeat then against Bayern Munich, which knocked them out of the Champions League at the quarterfinal stage. In the Premier League, they are still second, ahead of Liverpool on goal difference. They both have 71 points. They are 2 points behind the leaders, Manchester City. Are they running out of steam, do you think? Because they've got a bit of a habit of doing this over the last couple of seasons. It was 3 out of their final 9 games last season, 6 out of their last 12 in the 2021-22 season that they'd won. Are they on the verge? Is this their bad week? Is this where it all sort of comes unstuck?
I don't know. I feel like Liverpool have massively imploded. You know, the two home games they had, Atalanta and Palace. They should be winning those games, not losing both of them. Felt like a bit of a bottle job to me. I don't see that with Arsenal. I see Arsenal, yes, tired. And I think Arteta said the other day, if we were in most other European leagues, we'd be 6 to 8 points clear. You know, it's ridiculous the standards that we have to reach. And he's probably had an over-reliance on too many players, I think. If you look at like Saka and Odegaard and Rice, they're probably a bit tired. But to be honest, they played Aston Villa at home, who they'd already lost to this season. And you knew Emery was going to come with a plan. And Villa are the fourth best team in the country. And, you know, we said last week, Arsenal could struggle in this one. And Bayern Munich, who are managed by a guy who's won the Champions League. They've got players who've won the Champions League. They've saved all their energy and good performances for the Champions League in recent weeks. So I don't know, if you look at those two games or three games with the two legs, Arsenal come up a little bit short and a bit of a lack of experience in Munich on Wednesday night. But otherwise, it doesn't feel like an implosion to me. A Saturday night will be the test, because if they go and lose at Molineux, then yeah, I think you can say the wheels have really come off. But it doesn't feel like that to me. We've got their form before last week was astonishing. They'd won 10 of 11 in the Premier League, with a 0-0 draw at Man City being the 11th. They hadn't been behind in a game all year in the Premier League, which I found amazing. And I've got to say, the Arsenal fans sort of, I know we've got quite a few listening, and there's one in the booth behind
us. Yeah, two. Rachel and Mike. Yeah.
But the way that, you know, there were 7 minutes of stoppage time for that Villa game and half the Emirates emptied and Zinchenko's getting criticised. I think he had a few boos when he was subbed off. After not being behind all year, I felt they were sort of waving the white flag very early on.
What's your social media?
Do you know what I mean, though?
Yeah, well, that's... Yes, I do. I do know what you mean.
I couldn't believe how quickly it emptied.
But I think it was more of a reflection on, hang on a minute, are things coming unstuck? And the anger, the fear that they'd sort of let this
probably familiarity from a year ago, I guess.
But, exactly.
But they're only 2 points behind City.
That's the point. And even after everything you've said, you ended it, I was going to potentially clip up that and, you know, send it on WhatsApp to Mikel Arteta. I haven't got his number. Because it was inspirational. Arsenal are still in a good situation.
They are.
I mean, they could be Chelsea, Liam. They could be Chelsea. They could be in a complete mess. But they're still in the mix. And I suppose now it is about how they deal with those two body blows against Aston Villa, against Bayern Munich, and get back on track. They're not a million miles away.
I mean, they were Chelsea a few years ago, minus the incredible spending. They're not in a terrible place, Arsenal. I don't agree when Arteta says, you know, that any other league we'd be 6 to 8 points clear. They've lost 5 games this season in the Premier League already. They've won 22 of 32, which is good, but it's not the standard that we've seen in this league over the last 5 to 7 years. I know what he's getting at, because peak Manchester City and peak Liverpool raised the bar for winning the Premier League to heights that we've never seen before in terms of points. But neither of those teams are in the league this year, like the peak versions of them. The maximum number of points City can finish with is 91, which is a lot, but it's a good 4 to 5 points less at a minimum from the heights that they were regularly scaling under Guardiola. So this is actually an opportunity for Arsenal and for Liverpool, because City have slipped a little bit. And I think coming out with things like that, if you're Arteta, risks creating a little bit of a woe is me culture rather than, you know, trying to rally the troops and saying, look, we've still got a great opportunity here, an opportunity that we might not get every year to win the league with mid to high 80s points. That's definitely there, because we've seen City have been very, very consistent in the league the last couple of months, but they're not invulnerable, as Real Madrid showed, particularly away from home. I think they can be a little bit more vulnerable this year. So it's there for Arsenal. It's there for Liverpool if they can just get out of their own way. I'd fancy Arsenal to do that a bit more than Liverpool, just because I think they're a little bit more of a controlled team. There isn't the huge, overwhelming emotional pressure that Liverpool have with Klopp's impending departure. And Arsenal, prior to the Villa game, had the best defence in the league as well. And I think that's a great foundation on which to actually go and win the title.
For the Arsenal fans that are getting a little bit nervy, a bit worried, give them a scouting report on Wolves at the moment, Tim, because I was listening to the radio last weekend. I heard Gary O'Neill speaking after the game against Nottingham Forest, bemoaning the amount of injuries, but at the same time, not bemoaning it, saying it's not an excuse, but then saying, oh, we've got so many injuries. So he was sort of doing a semi-whinge wrapped up in, I'm happy and proud of the players, etc. We're really stretched. We've only got 12 players and all that malarkey. Tell us why Arsenal potentially should be worried or not.
Well, I mean, Wolves are in their worst form of the season. You know, you mentioned the Coventry Court final that I haven't won since then. And yeah, they've had some injuries. They haven't had the glut of injuries that sort of Chelsea and Newcastle have had. Newcastle got a full team out at the moment. They're still going to beat Spurs easily last week. You don't see Eddie Howe, you know, moaning after that one.
Gary O'Neill, so he's never known a situation like it in his managerial or playing career.
Really?
Said, yeah, he said that on the radio.
There are a few that I've missed. That's weird. Well, they've had injuries to key players. That's been Wolves' problem. So the whole front three has been wiped out. And we saw at Forest last week, Mateus Cunha is now back. And what a difference he made. Scored 2 goals. One of them was remarkable. Completely on his own in the Forest half. Still managed to score. So, yeah, but I guess reasons that Arsenal fans should be concerned would be Wolves got a good record against some of the good teams this season. They beat Man City at home. They beat Spurs home and away. They also beat Chelsea home and away. And they have the capability to do that because they're very well organised. They're very well coached. They don't mind sitting deep and sort of relinquishing possession. They've got a couple of real midfield terriers. Lamina and Joao Gomez are right up there with almost anyone in the league for sort of tackling numbers this season. And then if everyone's fit, they've got this electrifying pace on the counter-attack. Pedro Neto is still out, which is a huge blow. But through Cunha, who's in the form of his career, there is someone to be worried about.
Right. Score predictions. Liam, quick one from you, please.
I think Arsenal will win this 2-0.
2-0. It was 2-1 to Arsenal in the reverse fixture. Tim, it's going to be...
3-1 to Arsenal.
Oh. Yeah, but you're only doing that because then you're going to go, ooh, look, yeah, I predicted an Arsenal win. I'm so happy that Wolves won. Can't believe it on next week's show. Yeah? Brilliant. Jolly good. Remember, we are on YouTube, so when you do put your thumb up...
That was for the YouTube. That was just for YouTube. I didn't want anyone to hear that. I don't want the listeners to hear that. It was just for thumbs up for YouTube.
That was a YouTube exclusive. Brilliant. Right. Obviously, we're talking about Arsenal on the theme of Arsenal, Manchester City, the title race as a whole. Liverpool, who face Fulham on Sunday in action last night, Thursday night, looking to overturn that 3-0 deficit against Atalanta in the Europa League. Here's Andy Jones on how it all panned out in that second leg of their quarterfinal clash.
Jurgen Klopp's European adventures for Liverpool is over. And it was with a bit of a whimper in the end. The game had all the hallmarks for, you know, another memorable comeback. But Liverpool were thrown worst enemies again in front of goal. Salah, the main culprit, missing the biggest chance when sent through. He lobbed wide of the Atalanta goal with goalkeeper Musso stranded. And then in the second half, Liverpool went down with a bit of a whimper in the end. The siege on Atalanta's goal never came. The home side adjusted and seemed to gain calmness and confidence as the game went on. And Liverpool were unable to fashion any real chances in the second half, which was a massive disappointment and not the way they were to plan this night.
Right, let's focus on some of the relegation battles this weekend. And there are some really, really interesting games that we've got. Sheffield United against Burnley. I mean, Tim, last week you condemned Burnley to relegation. They're too far away, et cetera, et cetera. So you're condemning both of those teams. So that game, you don't really care. Sheffield United against Burnley. Is that the long and short of it?
It's really difficult to make a
case. Right, fine. Well, let's move on quickly then. Luton, they have got a chance of getting out of it. 25 points. They're in 18th. So just 1 point behind Nottingham Forest and 2 points behind Everton. Everton and Forest take on each other. We'll talk about that in a moment. But Luton against Brentford, this is a must win, isn't it, Liam, for Luton?
Yeah, I think so. And it's an opportunity for them because I think Brentford, I don't know if they feel safe, but they probably should feel safe now. They're 7 points clear with 5 games left. I don't see any way for Brentford to actually get dragged right down into it. So Luton should have the greater drive and the hunger in this game and the greater desperation. And we've seen from them, I think, throughout the season, they just don't stop coming. You know, they don't have an amazing individual talent level, but they are pretty well coached. They've got fantastic collective spirit. And even when games look to be getting away from them, they don't stop trying to get back. And I think as long as you do that, you've got a chance. We've seen, particularly before the change of coach, you know, Sheffield United throw the towel in a lot. I think Burnley have been guilty of that at times this season as well. I can't remember many occasions when Luton have done it. And as long as you do that, you've got a chance. But they have to put it all together into a proper performance against Brentford with as few mistakes as possible.
Going into the game between Everton and Nottingham Forest, mm-hmm. I mean, Liam used the phrase they're throwing in the towel. It was very odd to see a Sean Dyche side throw in the towel, which they, I mean, maybe it's unfair, but I mean, it was chaotic at times against Chelsea. What's your feeling on that game in particular, Everton against Nottingham Forest? Because, you know, if Forest win, Luton win, that could be Everton back in the relegation zone, couldn't it?
Yeah, if I was an Everton fan, I'd be worried. Luton and Forest's run-ins are both pretty good. You know, Luton have got Brentford, Wolves, Everton, West Ham, Fulham. That's a good run. Forest have got Everton. They do have Man City at home, but then they've got Sheffield United, Chelsea and Burnley. Whereas Everton have got Arsenal, Liverpool in their run-in. And Everton just aren't scoring goals at the moment. So the last 3 goals they've scored in the 4 games, they had Neto, the Bournemouth keeper, dropping the ball for Beto to score from a yard. They had a penalty at Newcastle, and then they had Calvert-Lewin charging down the Burnley, poor Burnley keeper's clearance. So they're sort of like not goals that you can really train for. And then they go and concede 6 the other night, which, as you say, is completely unlike even them this season and a Sean Dyche team in general. So yeah, whereas Forest have only lost 1 in 5, Forest have started scoring goals, and they look a bet to stay up at the moment. So it's looking like it's going to really tighten up even more so right until the last game of the season, I think.
We want a bit of jeopardy, though, don't we, towards the end of the season? It looks as if it's obviously going to potentially going to go to the wire at the top. We want the same at the bottom, don't we? We shall see. Okay, Liam, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, a pleasure. Good to talk to you guys.
And to Tim, great to be back in the studio with you, me old mucker.
Cheers, buddy.
Excellent. Right, that's all for today. I hope you have a great weekend. Io's going to be back on Monday. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching on YouTube. And yeah, we'll see you next time.
The Athletic.